Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. 56 men signed the Declaration of Independence, most during the summer of 1776. And if someone were to ask off the cuff who the signatories were, a few names would probably come to mind fairly quickly. John Hancock, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, New Jersey's Richard Stockton. How about Benjamin Rush? This hour, we're going to take a close look at the life of an enormously productive and prominent colonial-era Philadelphian whose story remains relatively unknown. Benjamin Rush was a protege of Benjamin Franklin, and as a matter of fact, is buried not far from Franklin at Christ Church Burial Grounds in Philadelphia. He was also a groundbreaking physician who advocated for mental health treatment at a time in which such care was virtually unheard of. Some call him the father of American psychiatry. Rush was an abolitionist, a prolific writer, treasurer of the U.S. Mint, something of a bon vivant, and he rubbed elbows with political luminaries like George Washington and John Adams. So why isn't he better known? Here to help us delve into the Benjamin Rush story is author Stephen Fried. His newest work is called Rush, Revolution, Madness, and the Visionary Doctor Who Became a Founding Father. And as always, lines are open. The number to call if you'd like to join the conversation is 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Stephen Fried, so nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, President John Adams once told a cabinet member that without some advice Benjamin Rush once imparted, quote, Mr. Washington would never have commanded our armies, nor Mr. Jefferson have been the author of the Declaration of Independence. That's a
pretty good endorsement.
Yeah,
Rush should have
used
that on one of his books. he said it after Rush died. What he's referring to is, when Rush was a young doctor in his 20s and not so politically active yet, he was part of the group that met the Massachusetts delegation when they came for the Continental Congress. And Adams was shocked to see that Rush, who was the youngest person there, the only person who wasn't going to be in the Continental Congress, was telling them all these things they should do. And part of the advice they gave was that while Massachusetts was the offended state because they were being attacked at that point, that if they didn't let Virginia lead, that there would be no union. He also tried to talk to Adams privately about Philadelphians and their loyalist tendencies because Philadelphia had the most to lose if there was independence. And he wanted Adams to know and the other delegates to know that Philadelphians would tell them they were in favor of independence, but many of them kind of weren't.
He was an enormous influencer. And again, yet many of us, the name just doesn't come to mind when we think of the Founding Fathers. So let's say that we've got an hour and there's a lot to cover here, Stephen.
Okay.
To begin, let's talk about the younger Benjamin Rush. You write that he was a medical and a political prodigy from a middle-class family on the humbler side of Philadelphia. He graduated from what we now know as Princeton University at the age of 14. Tell us a little bit about the fact that he was a prodigy.
Benjamin Rush, it's funny. Benjamin Rush, if you look at, we found the very old picture of Benjamin Rush, and his forehead is very pronounced. And people used to actually say that his brain had so many ideas bursting out of it that that's why his forehead was so big. He was just an incredibly smart. He had sort of a photographic memory and an unbelievable memory to connect things. So even though he was a blacksmith's son and his father died when he was five and the family did not have money, he was sent to good schools. He was sent to boarding school in Maryland. He was then sent to what became Princeton and then apprenticed here in Philadelphia with a Dr. John Redman and then went to the University of Edinburgh, which was the greatest medical school of the day. And so by the time he was in his 20s, he had had these amazing experiences. Interestingly, while Franklin lived down the street from him, his mom, after his father died, opened a package goods store on the 200 block of Market Street, mm-hmm. just near the Franklin printing shop. He met Franklin in London because Franklin was mostly in London during this time. And Franklin gave him letters of introduction to sort of all the literary figures that he had read at boarding school and in college who were still alive. So Rush, in his diaries from this time, recounts these amazing stories of meeting all these incredible writers, Samuel Johnson and sort of all these people. And then Rush comes back in his 20s to be a doctor. And you would not have guessed at this point that he was going to be a political person. He was a young doctor trying to make his way, and he was Presbyterian, second Presbyterian, so he felt religious persecution because he was not Quaker and he was not Church of England, and those are the people who controlled Philadelphia. Yeah. So he was going about his business trying to build up a practice, And then he got involved in revolutionary politics. The first thing he was involved with, he wrote a very well-known treatise, not only against slavery, but against racism against free blacks. And he took a perspective, a medical perspective. So he said, you know, many of my patients are African-American. They're no different than you. And that was kind of a new thing because most abolitionist writing was more political. Rush's was both political and medical. He also was part of the group that wrote the proclamation about tea that set off the Boston Tea Party. In Boston, they read the proclamation the Philadelphians wrote. They liked it so much they figured we don't need to write another one. So they put that in their papers too. And that's what, you know, ignited everybody to go down and do the Tea Party. So he was involved in politics on the side. But he was mostly trying to build a practice. And what we like about Rush is that he always talks about the real world of building the revolution and the real world of trying to be a young businessman in colonial Philadelphia. So, and he has great psychological insights into people.
So let's fast forward to October of 1774. And I think this hour we're going to be skipping back and
That's
forth
fine.
A little bit in time. The First Continental Congress has been convened. Benjamin Rush has by this time rubbed elbows with John Adams, who would be our second president. He's been invited to a dinner at the home of Pennsylvania delegate Tom Mifflin, who's also invited a decorated military leader named George Washington. What were their early dealings like, Rush and Washington?
You know, you have to keep in mind, one, we recreate their dealings from letters. So I don't want to pretend that we were in the room for all these things. But Rush had great admiration for Washington. He certainly was somebody who supported Washington being the general, and they were friends. From all indications, you know, the day after that dinner, Washington came to Rush's house for tea. So they socialized, and I don't think Washington knew at that point that Rush was going to matter politically as much as he did because, of course, you know, 2 years later, Rush was a member of the Continental Congress and technically his boss. But they had interesting conversations. They liked each other. I would say that Rush was initially most fascinated by Adams, and it's not surprising that that was the friendship that endured for a long period of time. Adams and Washington had a much more different relationship, very fascinating, sometimes fraught.
What was it about Benjamin Rush that prompted these luminaries, these political luminaries of the time, to bring him into their circle?
I think he was a great talker. I think he was very interesting.
He was a prolific writer.
He was a really good writer, which was very useful because if people were talking and they needed something written, Benjamin Rush could sit down and write it really fast. So that was valuable. But I think people just found him interesting. I think they thought that he was also a gossip, which was both good and bad. Keep in mind, all these Continental Congressmen were coming to Philly. They needed to know, like, where to eat, you know, basic things like that. He also served as their doctor. So he gave Patrick Henry his smallpox inoculation. Mm. So they knew him in all these different ways at the beginning, and that unfolded during his entire life. The fact that he was an important politician, the fact that he was many of these people's family doctor.
And he was brilliant.
He was very brilliant. I mean, no one denied that. He was very opinionated, sometimes overly opinionated. And because he was such a good, fast writer, he would sometimes write things that he later – he's perfect for our era right now because he's a guy who pushes send way too quickly in lots of things. And then just sort of later, you know, either says like, okay, I'm changing that, or he would revise things. But he just had a very active mind, gregarious mind. He was also fascinated with other people. I think that he was like a therapist. So it wasn't just that he talked a lot about his ideas. He was great at drawing people out. And it was a real talent that people recognized early on about him. I mean, the reason that Princeton University, for example, was saved, John Witherspoon became president of Princeton, and that was the turning point for Princeton. Up to that point, they had had four presidents die in like 8 years, is because Rush helped convince his wife, who was afraid to travel from Scotland, that they should come to America. And that really is the beginning of Princeton's greatness. So, and everybody attributes that to Rush sitting and talking to Mrs. Witherspoon in a way that no one else could have. So there was something about him that people liked to talk to him. He's the father of American psychiatry, but he's also the father of American clinical psychology.
We're going to get into a lot of that as the hour goes on.
Okay.
Let's get back to his part in signing the Declaration of Independence. There was, as you write, great risk to signing the Declaration of Independence at that time. Tell us what that was.
Yeah, Rush's description of actually being in the room is wonderful because he's basically describing that they're all putting their names on something that could get them killed. I mean, it's like a list of people that if the British are coming to stop the revolution, well, let's kill these guys first. So he His writing on this is very dark. At one point, he talks about the silence in the room as each person goes up. But he can't ignore gallows humor. So he describes two congressmen going up to sign, one a big heavyset guy, the other one Eldridge Gerry, who's very skinny. And the heavyset guy says, you know, when we're killed for signing this, when I hang, I'm going to die really fast because I'm heavy and I'm just going to go. And because you're a skinny guy, you're going to dangle for a really long time. So we have these little moments because they're in Rush's commonplace books. Rush wrote a lot of notes about what he saw. The way I think of it is not only don't we know Rush's story, but what Rush provides us is it's like there was a camera running during the entire American Revolution and no one developed the film until now. Yeah. Some of the things are familiar, just seen from a different angle. Some are things that you never knew happened before because Rush was the only witness to them. But that's one of the values of Rush. He was everywhere, and wherever he wasn't, people told him what had happened, and he wrote a lot of it down.
So if he was so intimately involved in this part of American history, why is he not better known? If you were to ask somebody on the street, you know, you say the name Benjamin Rush, it might take a
while. It's interesting. When Rush was when Rush died in 1813, the newspapers described his death as being similar to the death of Washington and Franklin. That's how big a deal he was. Yeah. He did not serve in public office except for being in the Continental Congress and being the treasurer of the Mint. I think that he felt that he was not a good politician. And he just didn't want to, he was a doctor. He needed to earn his living as a doctor. But interestingly, what happened, and we did a lot of research on this, like why don't we know this guy? And the reason is that everybody was so open with him, especially Jefferson and Adams, with whom he wrote hundreds and hundreds of letters later in his career. He also wrote an autobiography in which he listed every person who signed the Declaration and what he really thought of them, sort of like the Revolutionary War burn book. And so the family was afraid for these things to come out. He also had a run-in with Washington, which the family, as Washington became more and more famous, didn't want to know. So his story was quashed in terms of all the most interesting writing was kept quiet for a period of time by his own family. I don't think that they realized it would last this long. The Rushes married into the Biddle family. The Biddle family held the material. Eventually, the children of Alexander Biddle all passed away. And in the 1940s, there was this huge auction at Park Bernay. 900 items from the colonial era, letters no one had ever seen, Rush's autobiography, letters from Adams, Jefferson, Washington, Franklin, all auctioned off. It's one of the great turning points in the history of American history. So, but Rush still does not have his rightful place. I don't know. Maybe he didn't have as good a publicist. No one's made a musical about him yet.
Yet.
Anybody listening, please do. And I think that the process since World War II has been our constant reevaluation and rediscovery of the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers were not as well known before World War II as they were after the scholarship and history writing that came after that. And even John Adams, I mean, John Adams is in our face now, but the John Adams, David McCulloch biography came out in 2001. So a lot of these things are more modern than we think. We're just used to them. Everybody knows who Hamilton is, but 5 years ago, no one knew who Hamilton was. There's an incredible thirst to get to know the founders. Yeah. And I was really lucky that Rush was available.
Well, more of us will know who Benjamin Rush is after this hour. Stephen Fried is our guest. He is the author of Rush, Revolution, Madness, and the Visionary Doctor Who Became a Founding Father. We'll talk about Rush's history as an abolitionist, also as a physician who pushed for mental health care at a time in which that wasn't the norm. This is Radio Times. Stay with us. More just ahead. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today, and our guest in studio is Stephen Fried, journalist and author who teaches at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is Rush, Revolution, Madness, and the Visionary Doctor Who Became a Founding Father. We've got a lot of material we'll try to cover here this hour. He had his hand in so many things, Dr. Benjamin Rush did. The number to call if you'd like to join the conversation is 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. So let's get to the fact that Benjamin Rush was an abolitionist, that at a time when slavery was being phased out in Pennsylvania, and he did own an enslaved person. So how do we explain that?
You know, it was really interesting, the research for this, because what we found is the literature was incorrect. Rush himself wrote that he had one slave and that he had that slave for 10 years. But the literature said that every servant he had who had the same first name as that slave was a different slave. And so they suggested that when he wrote his treatise on abolition that he was being hypocritical, but it turns out to be wrong. We were very lucky. You know, Richard Newman, one of the world's experts on colonial slavery and African-American life, was running the library company during the time we were working on the book, and we would have private meetings with him to try to parse this out because the history is hard. But basically, Rush was committed to abolition from a very particular perspective, politically and medically, because he thought it was really important that people understand that African-Americans were the same as white people. We don't know why he bought this enslaved person, William Grubber, in the late 1780s. He suggests in his writing that Grubber had a drinking problem and that he helped him overcome that. I don't want to excuse him by saying that he did that for that reason, but sure. Some historians have suggested that. Grubber worked on boats as a cook, and he would come back and be in the Rush house as a cook. And he and Rush were obviously close because Rush wrote about their relationship. When Rush was dying, Grubber was the one who insisted on sitting with him overnight when everybody else was asleep because he wanted to be there if he died. Grubber was freed sometime in the late 1780s. We don't have exact documents. We have his manumission papers, but not when they actually were executed. But what we know is when he came back, he was ill. He came back to the Rush household. Rush had him admitted to Pennsylvania Hospital, agreed to pay. We found these records at Pennsylvania Hospital, agreed to pay for his funeral. And when he died, Rush took care of all that. It's an interesting relationship. I wish we knew more about it, and I wish that it had not been misreported. But a lot of Rush scholarship was done very quickly in the 1950s when all these documents came out, and many of them haven't been updated since. So we did some of this work that if it was John Adams, somebody would have done it by now.
Yeah. There's a lot of terrific local Philadelphia history in this book. For instance, you write that the Rush family lived a block and a half from the main slave auction stand for Philadelphia's port, which was located on Market Street, just past Second. And I haven't been down there in a while. I haven't walked down there, so I'll have to look to see if there's a marker or something.
I don't know if there is. There were actually two. The original one was in front of what was called the Indian Queen, which is a little further up Market. Mm-hmm. And then it moved to the corner of Market and Front. These little things are really hard. You know, one of the things that was cool, most histories of the American Revolution are not written through Philadelphia. People don't care about Philadelphia. They care about Boston. They care about Virginia. They care about the battlefields. Well, but everything cool happened here.
That was my question.
Yeah, wanted to write a book that was seen through the prism of Philadelphia. And except for the 2 years he was in medical school, Rush was always here. So you really get that kind of feeling. And keep in mind, Philadelphia existed from Pine Street to Arch at that time, the river to 8th or 9th. Okay. All the revolution took place in this very tiny area of the city.
You also tell a remarkable story of an invitation to Rush to help celebrate the raising of the roof for what was the first black church in Philly.
Yes.
And this was, I think, in 1793 and involved an extraordinary dinner for whites and blacks.
Yes. Rush had become friendly with Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, who were two freed slaves who wanted to create a black church. They eventually created two black churches, best known as the Mother Bethel Church, where I'm going to be speaking next week, actually. So they were doing a roof raising for this church, and what happened was they invited the white people who had helped fund the church. Rush had written the plan for the church, and the African Americans who were working on the church, they served the white people who had helped. And then after they ate, the white people all got up, and then they served the African-Americans who had just served them.
Well, let us know. I mean, extraordinary for the times, no?
I think amazing for the times. We only know about it because Rush mentions it in a letter to his wife the day after it happens. I mean, you kind of wish that other people had written about it because it's kind of so cinematic. But it was – and what's also cinematic about it, of course, is that this happened on the eve of the yellow fever epidemic. So the yellow fever epidemic was actually already starting. They didn't know that then, but within a few days, they figured out that yellow fever was there too. So 1793, we have a big anniversary of it just now, was a huge turning point in Philadelphia. But the race relations that Rush was part of are fascinating. His relationship with Allen and Jones, really interesting. People don't pay enough attention to it. It's the beginning of the conversation about diversity in America. It's the beginning of the conversation not only about slavery, because slavery got kicked down the road, but the conversation about prejudice, because Rush, as a doctor, felt that what he could help with at that time was to get white people to examine why they were prejudiced against African Americans just because of the color of their skin. And that's what a lot of his writing is about from this time.
So you mentioned yellow fever. We have a tweet from Kim who says, interesting interview. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you,
Kim. I wonder whether your guest can comment on Rush's role in the 1793 yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia. As a matter of fact, there were a number of yellow fever epidemics. And I think at one point, What was it? Did you say, was it 10% of the population?
In the 1793 one, 10% of the population died in 3 months. And there were several others later in the 1790s, which is part of the reason that Philadelphia did not get to continue as the U.S. capital. Russia's role in yellow fever is unbelievably dramatic. It's been written about before. We actually tried to deconstruct it because I think a lot of the writing from the past suggested that somebody should have been able to figure out what yellow fever was. And all medical experts say that that was not possible. But Rush, you know, went, got yellow fever himself. He worked with the African-American clergy to help take care of people when they felt that it was out of control and they couldn't take care of people. They actually published the treatments in the newspaper and told them to take purgatives themselves if they could get somebody to do bloodletting for them to come have people do it at their houses.
And these were the treatments at the time.
They were.
Purgatives, bloodletting.
Yes. I have a little cold today. I did think this morning maybe I would try a little bloodletting, but I think not. Yeah, these were the treatments. And the question was, from a public health aspect, was how many people can we treat? Rush was known for being a guy. He would be out in his chair, which is a one-man horse-drawn carriage, and he would do house calls. Rush did house calls, endless house calls his whole career. This whole three-month period, unbelievably dramatic. Many of their friends died. Rush had people living in his house and being taken care of in his house. Many of them died. His sister died. Who was with him.
Yeah.
So it's very dramatic. We also found for the first time the letters that his wife Julia, a fascinating character, wrote to him from Princeton, where she was with the kids.
Right.
They had not been known, but the Philosophical Society turned out to have them.
And they did not know at the time that yellow fever was carried by mosquitoes.
No, not at all. They had no idea what any of the treatments were.
Those who were mentally ill at the time often likely received terrible treatment. Benjamin Rush played a significant role in helping Pennsylvania Hospital recover after the Revolutionary War. I'd like you to read for us what Rush witnessed as he did his work as a physician at that hospital. And it's on page 264, I believe, of your book.
Thank you. This is from a description that somebody who came there wrote in a letter of Rush giving rounds. Mm-hmm. The rounds finished in the lower, partially underground story, where Rush and his students took a view of the maniacs in their locked ward, which had individual locked cells, quote, about 10 feet square, made as strong as a prison. Each cell door had, quote, a hole large enough to give them food, which is closed with a little door secured with strong bolts. Each cell had a high window high up on the wall with a large iron gate inside to prevent the patient from reaching and breaking the glass. The ward was filled to its capacity with about 30 patients, men and women. Some of them were extremely fierce and raving, the witness wrote, nearly or quite naked, some singing and dancing, some in despair, the visitor noted. Some were dumb and would not open their mouths, others incessantly talking. The gentleman found it, quote, curious indeed to see what different strains their distraction raged, a distressing view of what human nature is liable to.
So what impact did this have on Benjamin Rush?
Well, the first thing that Rush couldn't believe was that that the hospital had a policy that they did not believe that people with mental illness could feel hot or cold. So the cells that they lived in were not heated. They also allowed people to pay to come and see the maniacs. That's the
what
bad word.
What was the purpose there?
To make money.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, the hospital made money that way. I think that people thought there was no treatment for mental illness. People at that time believed that mental illness was demonic possession or weakness. And Rush, actually turns out, one of the things that we were really proud of in this book was the French and British often get credit for turning this old thinking around, but we found that at Pennsylvania Hospital, Rush was almost 10 years ahead of them in writing for the first time that mental illnesses and addictions were medical illnesses that needed to be addressed with medical treatments, the doctors needed to take them seriously medically the way they take all their illnesses, and that the hospital needed to do something about that. He forced them to buy heaters. He later forced them to build a brand new building. The building on 9th Street there was built only to treat people with mental illness and addiction. It's the first building in the world that was created specifically for quote-unquote modern treatment. We can debate what modern treatment was, but yeah, the fact that this was bringing the medicine of the day to try to quell mania, to quell psychosis, to quell untreatable depression, this is what Rush brought to this. His descriptions of the illness actually feel very modern. And he did this because he thought it was incredibly important. And ironically, later in his life, his son became mentally ill. So his oldest son,
severely,
who was a doctor.
He was really ill, John Rush.
His oldest son, John, who was a doctor, who was to take over Rush's practice, whose medical school treatise was on suicide in the 1800s, was in a duel with his best friend, killed his best friend, and went insane and tried to kill himself many times. And he ended up being a patient at Pennsylvania Hospital in the new building that his father had built for the treatment of mental illness. And he lived there for 30 years.
Stephen Fried, so why was there so little compassion at the time for the mentally ill? Was it because of fear? What do you think as an observer?
Well, you could ask the same question about today, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Some of these issues resonate today pretty much the same way. I think it's fear. I think it's lack of the unknown. I think people didn't understand that these were illnesses of the brain and not – it was part of – you know, all medicine was being recovered from religion. I mean, a lot of early medicine was more religious, and what doctors were trying to do was make it more scientific. The American Philosophical Society here in Philadelphia was very much part of that. So this was part of that, but the bigger issue for Rush was that mental illness and addiction, he thought, were first of all, the most important medical issues that were not being taken care of.
Was it spirituous liquors? Is that how it's what
yes.
it was called?
Yes. Well, he was very much concerned about addiction to alcohol, to spirits, to whiskey, gin. Interestingly, you know, temperance at his time didn't include wine or beer. Rush drank wine every day of his life.
And it was also a treatment in many medical
It was. It was
right?
medical. Wine. So, yeah. But it was – they were worried about addiction to hard liquors, and that's where sort of Rush drew the line.
So even with Benjamin Rush's concern and empathy and help for people who are mentally ill, the treatments were still fairly primitive. Just tell us briefly about the tranquilizer chair. Was that his?
Yes. Rush – you know, it's unfortunate that some of these devices now are seen by people somehow – I think people in the anti-psychiatry movement see these kinds of things as some kind of torture, which they were not at all. These were attempts. People who needed to be restrained, and this is still an issue in mental illness. There are some people who are so sick they need to be restrained. Rush did not want these people to be restrained in, you know, to be tied up. So he tried to create a chair that they could sit in that covered their eyes so they would not see what was going on around them, and that they could do treatments for them, and also they could go to the bathroom without being unraveled from their straitjackets. So that chair, it exists, actually. I was at the American Psychiatric Association the other day. They were talking about bringing it in. So these chairs, different devices were created by different people in England as well, too. Some of them had to do with blood flow. Rush and other people believe that mental illness had something to do with inadequate blood flow to the brain. It kind of a little bit does, but – and so they created something that slowly spun you around to get more blood to the brain. But this was rudimentary medicine, and the goal here is to understand this was bringing the medicine of the day, the best possible medicine that people had, to these illnesses which previously had been ignored as medical diseases.
Historian Stephen Fried has brought Benjamin Rush to life in his new book, Rush, Revolution, Madness, and the Visionary Doctor Who Became a Founding Father. If you'd like to join the conversation, here is the number, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have a tweet from Sheena who asks, how is it misreported that Rush had a slave when he wrote himself he had a slave for 10 years? Doesn't sound like misreporting, and it's not striking that an abolitionist would have a slave.
Again, I can't explain to you why Rush had a slave for 10 years. He actually wrote a fascinating essay right before he freed his slave, where he, in a dream, was taken to the paradise of the Negro slaves, and slaves told him about all the terrible things that white people had done to him, done to them, and wanted him to go back and explain to white people what they had done. I want the caller to be clear. What I said was misreported was not that he had a slave for 10 years. The literature said that he had slaves his entire life, and that turns out to be incorrect. And it's because his slave was named William, and the early historians who looked at Rush's letters took anybody whose name was William, who seemed to be a servant, and assumed that that was the same William and a slave.
She also referenced the fact that, and I think I'm remembering this correctly, that perhaps it wasn't unusual for abolitionists to own enslaved people as things were changing.
Again, I'm
What's
not trying to defend
historian?
Rush owning an enslaved person. I think Rush himself was actually kind of weirded out that he had done it.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about Rush himself, but at the time, as things were changing.
Well, the leading abolitionist traditionally in Philadelphia had been, or well-known one, was Benjamin Franklin. Yeah. Benjamin Franklin obviously had slaves.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's not – look, what we wanted to do was clear the record, be really accurate. I'm not trying to apologize for what Rush did, but rather to make sure that people understand when he had a slave, who the slave was, who the enslaved person was, and what the best that we can know what the experience is. But I'm not here to be his apologist. He wrote about these things himself.
Yeah.
I think that he understood the challenges here. But what actually happened, you know, interestingly, this abolition movement was pretty quiet during and after the war, and up to the time when the Constitution was being written, it picked up again then. That's when Rush and Benjamin Franklin restarted the Abolition Society. That's when the Free African Society was started by Jones and Allen. And that's when these relationships really got cemented. And that's when Rush freed his one slave. And what's interesting, and we looked everywhere, there's no mention that Rush had a slave at the time. So if somebody knew and was upset about it, there's no record of that at all.
Let's jump back to the actual, the Revolutionary War, the Battle of Princeton, when Washington's and General John Cadwalader's troops attacked the British and the Hessians. As Rush and other doctors approached Princeton, and Rush had been conscripted to tend to the wounded, you write, the first thing they saw was the field of battle, still red in many places with human blood. So how did this affect Benjamin Rush? This is his first experience.
You know, he wrote about it at the time. That description is from his books, from his commonplace books. And he wrote over the years many times that he flashed back on this. I think he had really traumatic experiences. Obviously, he had never seen this kind of thing before. And I think he flashed back on it a lot. I think we tend to look at the trauma experiences of war and think of them as first being about the Civil War. Mm-hmm. But they were very similar in the Revolutionary War. And I think that Rush was very unnerved by this. Keep in mind, that field was also right in front of Nassau Hall, where he had gone to college. So it wasn't just any field that was covered with blood, that he was taking care of people, some of whom he knew. I mean, he was taking care of General Hugh Mercer, who he had just had lunch with, who had surrendered to the British, and they bayoneted him seven times anyway and hit him in the head, and Rush had to treat him until he died. So it was very personal. At the same time, interesting, Richard Stockton, his father-in-law, had been kidnapped by the British, and no one knew where he was. So it's unbelievably dramatic what this guy went through and what his family went through.
He was an advocate for soldiers' health. We'll get into that some more after the break. You are listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. Stephen Fried has written Rush, Revolution, Madness, and the Visionary Doctor Who Became a Founding Father. That is Benjamin Rush. And join us if you'd like, 888-477-9499. There is more of Radio Times straight ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Benjamin Rush may not have been a household name, but the young signatory of the Declaration of Independence led a remarkable life. The Philadelphia native was a protege of Benjamin Franklin and co-authored a proclamation that inspired the Boston Tea Party. He founded Dickinson College, advocated for public education for women, and was a staunch abolitionist, and much more. Our guest this hour is Stephen Fried, journalist and author who teaches at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and the University of Pennsylvania. Stephen's latest book is Rush, Revolution, Madness, and the Visionary Doctor Who Became a Founding Father. So, Stephen, just a couple more minutes on Benjamin Rush and his concerns about soldier health. He lobbied to have George Washington's troops inoculated against smallpox, and you say this might have saved more lives than anything else done by Rush during the war?
Yes. I mean, the smallpox inoculation, because the earlier one had actually given too many people smallpox, people were still a little afraid of it. But Rush pushed for the more modern version, and that probably saved more soldiers than anything else. Because keep in mind, these hospitals for soldiers were not the healthiest places in the world. Part of Rush's goal was to keep people out of them. He was as much interested in preventive medicine as he was in the actual hands-on medicine. And when he wrote his proclamation about how to make sure that soldiers were well, it actually was focused on trying to get generals to pay attention to those issues, the preventive medicine issues.
So I'd like you to read a passage from the book.
Fine. This first sentence is probably the most famous sentence that Benjamin Rush ever wrote. Fatal experience has taught the people of America the truth that a greater proportion of men perish with sickness in all armies than fall by the sword. And this piece went on to basically, I'm reading for the book, much of his advice in this piece might seem obvious today, but in 1777, it was startling news to American soldiers that they should wear their hair short. He sort of brought the crew cut to American.
The GI crew cut.
Mm-hmm. Change their clothes more often, especially their socks, eat more vegetables, drink less alcohol, wash their hands and faces every day and their whole bodies several times a week, change the hay they slept on, dry their blankets in the sun. Along with these dictums, Rush insisted that soldiers keep the area around their tents perfectly clean of the offals of animals and of filth of all kind, which means go to the bathroom further away from your tent, idiots.
How was this received?
Oh, people, I mean, I think that the soldiers, I shouldn't say that we know this. I mean, the soldiers, I assume, liked it. Washington was so impressed by this. It ran on the newspaper first that he ordered it put into a pamphlet and given to every soldier. These orders were actually used up through the Civil War. They were such good, practical advice. And, you know, he also talked about people not marching in the morning when it was cooler, just sort of basic things that you would think of that people had not really thought of before. But Rush was – he was really a public health advocate and a writer as much as a hands-on doctor. And whenever he saw something that was wrong, he wanted to write something. And his writing is very active and very user-friendly. He never wrote, like, science papers just for scientists. That's why it's so great. You can quote him. He's always engaging, interesting, even when he's wrong. He's always a good writer.
So we've been talking about the attributes of Benjamin Rush, and we will continue to do so. But what were some of his flaws?
He was very opinionated. He spoke sometimes too quickly and thought secondarily. I think that he his gossip was both considered a really good thing, but sometimes got him in the trouble. I mean, the reason that he had a historic issue with George Washington. And his issue with George Washington came from the fact that the generals were gossiping to Rush as a legislator that they thought during 1777, early 1778, that Washington's choices for generals may have been a mistake because we were really getting our butts kicked. I mean, people forget how bad the war was then. And so Rush simply repeated the things that he had heard from the different generals, and that got him into trouble. He wrote a letter, an unsigned letter to Patrick Henry repeating some of these things. Patrick Henry worried that this was part of a perhaps some kind of cabal to take down Washington, which I don't think it was, held the letter. He and Washington were – Rush and Washington at this time were going back and forth on another issue. Rush wanted Washington to spend more money on medical care for the troops. Washington and Rush actually made peace. Washington agreed to the things that Rush wanted. This letter sat in limbo for 2 months, and then Patrick Henry forwarded it to Washington. And Washington knew Rush's handwriting because they were friends, and he had a lot of letters from him. And he was incredibly angry at Rush, even though he had heard all these complaints before, to hear them from a friend, from a former congressman, from somebody who could influence his life. And Washington never forgave Rush for that. And that hung over his life. And I think that there are probably other things that Rush did that nobody forgave him for that we don't know about.
Was his propensity for talking too much and revealing too much, perhaps did that stymie any political aspirations he might have had?
I think more he understood that his thing with talking too much probably was a reason that he should not have political aspirations. When the country came to Philadelphia, and, you know, Philadelphians sometimes forget, Philadelphia was the capital of America from, you know, 1790 to 1800. It's an unbelievably fascinating period. And Rush at that time certainly could have been a cabinet minister. He could have done that. I think part of him wondered why no one asked, and part of him was happy that no one asked. And he and Adams actually wrote about this. One of the best things is that Adams and Rush wrote endless letters to each other. They became unbelievably close friends, and their letters to each other are so rich, especially their letters later in life, these sort of two cranky old guys sitting around asking, like, what is this country that we created? What's it going to turn into? They were fascinated with the way that fame had taken over America, that now there was no king, that fame was powerful, and they both were amazed that George Washington and Benjamin Franklin were famous, and they were less famous.
Well, and there were questions when George Washington was first inaugurated, as our first president, as to how this would all shape, you know, whether he would be considered a monarch or a president.
Yes, and that debate, interestingly, Adams wrote about that. He wasn't sure what the presidency should be. And these are perfectly reasonable questions. No one had ever been a president before. But later people suggested that Adams, especially when he was president, thought the president should be more of a monarchy, and that hung over him. So the other thing to keep in mind is this is also the birth of American media. So Philadelphia all of a sudden has a handful of daily newspapers, very political. So if you think that this was just invented during the internet age, the time when people started paying attention to what people said, fake news, because there was fake news, people made up stuff and put it in the newspapers. These guys went from being in a situation where they were at a Continental Congress where nobody was paying attention to being in the glare of media in Philadelphia for the first time. And Adams and Jefferson and Rush too. You know, Rush ended up suing a journalist who wrote that he had killed everybody during the yellow fever epidemic, not yellow fever. And so it was very fraught. By the end of the by 1800, when that election came between Adams and Jefferson, Rush's two close friends, they were all wondering whether they had already destroyed the country.
Hmm. Be interesting to ponder how this might play out in modern times with that same cast of characters. But anyway, that's another show. Benjamin Rush was a man of faith, but at one point, as the rules were being debated for the Pennsylvania Constitutional Convention, anyone who wanted to be a candidate would have had to swear a religious oath, a Christian oath.
Yes.
And again, he was Christian, but as you write, according to minutes from the Constitutional Conference, he was the proposal's chief and zealous opposer. What was he thinking about the role religion should play in the new American democracy?
Rush was a Christian man who believed in belief and believed in God and believed in Jesus. He also believed that the American Revolution was fought to have religious freedom and that religious freedom was going to be as hard as democracy. Because just because there was a majority of Christians didn't mean that this should be, in his eyes, a Christian nation. It needed to be a nation where everybody could worship.
One of his close friends was Jonas Phillips.
Jonas Phillips, who was the president of Mikveh Israel, the first major Jewish synagogue here, who was the driving force between the language and the Constitution separating church and state. So what Rush wanted to make sure – he was also just fascinated with people who didn't believe. Because a lot of his friends who were scientists were deists, and he didn't understand that either. But he had a very open-minded approach to this. He just wanted to know what people believed. He wanted to talk to them about religion. His conversations with Jefferson, with Joseph Priestley, with Adams about religion are really challenging, really interesting. They're the same questions we're having today about whether we respect each other's religious beliefs. And if you want to see – you know, Rush is like a – he's like a social justice – you know, precursor to everything. When I was telling my 24-year-old nephew about all the things Rush did, it's like, this is what all young people care about today. Equality, you know, equality for women, equality for for people of different races, and these issues having to do with equality of religion.
So fair to say that Benjamin Rush helped to set the stage for the debate around the separation of church and state.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what's amazing is because he was so concerned that when there were public schools, which he first proposed, that he wasn't sure how the Bible would fit into them because all previous schools had been religious schools, some of that language is now used to suggest that he believed that all schools should be completely religious, which he kind of didn't. It's important to really look at what Rush said. He's a very quotable guy. Some of his quotes have been a little bit abused for people's different causes, and getting to know him a little better will surprise some people about some of these quotes that they've seen than what he really meant.
Let's get to the phones. Cletus joins us from Bristol, Pennsylvania. Hi. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks, Mary. As always, another good show. Thanks, Mr. Fried. I wonder if you might know anything about the fact that evidently Benjamin Rush's, I guess, retirement house after he left Philadelphia was torn down by mistake back in the 70s. It was in the middle of nowhere, far northeast Philadelphia. It's still in the ruins, or in what are still woods. And the city evidently found out about this. They promised to rebuild it. They saved all the stones. But as far as I know, it was never rebuilt. There might be a plaque on the road where it is up by the Philadelphia Northeast Airport. It's an anecdotal thing.
No, I've actually... Interestingly,
thanks for the call.
I've met people who were involved in the effort to try to use those stones to rebuild a house in Benjamin Rush State Park. But we don't have a really good memorial to Rush. You know, the only statue to Rush in Pennsylvania is at Dickinson College, which he founded. Mm. And here in Philadelphia, we have a Benjamin Rush Memorial Garden on Walnut Street, but none of the houses that he lived in and treated patients in still stand. So that house... maybe rebuilt sometime, that would be great. But there are people who are – I must say I've met many people who are obsessed with Rush, who were really happy to see that somebody wrote a new biography of him. And in Philadelphia, there are many local causes around Rush that people have been doing research on for a long time, and I'm happy to help encourage them.
So one more thing I wanted to get to. He founded Dickinson College. He wanted to create a public school system in Pennsylvania, which were to include – women, which was revolutionary
yes.
at the time. He felt that women need to be educated as men were, and why?
Yes. Well, he looked at it first because women were going to be the ones who were going to teach the children more than men. But he also believed in equality. His wife, Julia Stockton Rush, her mother, Anna Boudinot Stockton, was one of the first published female writers in America. They were part of a co-ed salon group in Philadelphia that did literary readings, and the women were writers. So Rush came from a world where women were more equal. When he and Julia got married, he created a library in the room next to her and announced the first 100 books he was buying that she could read and they could discuss together. Mm-hmm. So they had kind of a different kind of relationship. It's not surprising that they were couple friends with the Adamses, and we see the couples that sort of were in love and who had active relationships and those who didn't see each other very much. Rush also, we haven't talked about, was the editor of Common Sense.
Yes.
And I don't want to miss out on the Thomas Paine episode because it is so crucial and so interesting.
Well, he convinced Thomas Paine to write Common Sense?
Rush had started a pamphlet on independence, and he then thought that his pamphlet on abolition had hurt his career so badly that maybe he should find somebody who is less in danger. So he met Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine was a freelance writer. As a freelance writer myself, I must say I was very touched that Rush explained, well, if a freelance writer's life is destroyed by writing something, what's the big deal compared to a doctor? Rush actually wrote that. So he convinced Paine to write it, and they worked together. Paine would bring him pages. He would read them and edit them, and then he actually gave Common Sense its title because Paine had been calling it Plain Truth, and he arranged for it to be published. And then when it came out, they all pretended they didn't know who wrote it because it was supposed to be a big mystery. But I can only imagine – no one wrote that much about what it was like. Can you only imagine these two guys, you know, sitting working on this pamphlet that within weeks changes the world. It becomes so many people read it. So many people buy it. Look at what we think about it. But neither Rush nor Paine really wrote so much about the experience of that. So I just tried to make sure the reader understood what was going on. Yeah. But they had done this, you know, very quietly in the fall of 1775. And it's a fascinating part of Rush's life.
It's incredible stuff. Let's get to some comments before we wrap up the hour. We've got a tweet from Joseph who says, what was Rush's long-term influence on prison reform, like, for example, at Eastern State Penitentiary? How did he draw the line between criminality and mental illness? Did you come across that in your research?
Yeah, Rush and Franklin did work on prisons in the 1780s, and Rush did further on. He viewed the prison situation as being part of his work also in terms of racism. And what was interesting is he had very strong ideas about everything in the prison system, including the way that prisoners were brought out to do work in the city and they had to wear orange jumpsuits. And he raised the question of whether psychologically that would be more likely to embarrass them and make them more likely to commit crimes again. So he was fascinated by all this. He thought the way that prisons ran was really wrong. And you could write a whole book just on what he was interested in this. And it has been interesting. I think that sometimes people get the impression that Rush built everything out of his ideas. His ideas inspired a lot of things that were built later.
Interesting.
One of the things when you're writing history, you always got to look at what year things were built and see when the people died. Because sometimes people tell you this whole story that this guy did this and say, okay, but he was dead then.
Yes.
So he influenced the thing, but he didn't do it.
We got a comment from Chris. I have a fairly serious mental illness that I manage. I also work in behavioral health in Philadelphia. I can tell you that 200 years after Rush, the taboo around the topic remains the same.
Yep. I mean, I got interested in Rush initially because of mental illness. I do a lot of writing about mental illness. My last book was a book that I wrote with Congressman Patrick Kennedy called A Common Struggle about his mental illness and the politics of mental illness. While this became a full biography, I found out about Rush because of mental illness. And the fact that his championing of it is even more interesting than people realized, and that this is an American story of Americans first paying attention to these illnesses, I think is really important. I've been talking to the leading advocates in the country to how they can use Rush's story, because I think it's important for them to know that one of the founding fathers really cared about their issues. Rush wrote about mental health parity, a thing we are still fighting for today, in the 1780s and 1790s. These issues were very clear as soon as you start thinking about these illnesses being medical, what is going to be done to make sure that these people get treatment, they get diagnosis, they are treated better by society. These are the ongoing challenges, and they're always going to be the ongoing challenges.
Quick comment from Laura. She says, the folk singer Tom Rush is actually a direct descendant of Benjamin Rush and named his son after him.
I've heard that. I don't know if it's true or not, but there's a lot of people who say they're related to Benjamin Rush, and that's why they have genealogy.
All right. Fun note to end the show on. Stephen Fried, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks
Radio
so much
Times.
For having me.
It's great to have you here. His latest book is Rush, Revolution, Madness, and the Visionary Doctor Who Became a Founding Father. And as always, we invite you to follow us at Radio Times on social media. Check out our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times. Thank you.